Hi, everybody. Welcome to The Librarian is In, the New York Public Library's podcast about books, culture, and what to read next. I'm Gwen.
And I'm Gloria Estefan.
And today we're going to conga
you. And the Miami Sound Machine are here.
The Miami Sound. How great would that be?
Our guest. Actually, no guest today, just us.
Right, just us today.
If that disturbs any listeners, just tune out.
Right, I'm sorry about the Miami Sound Machine. This is really disappointing.
We tried.
But next week, we are going to have Jay Vissers, who is he's a senior librarian at the Picture Collection in Mid-Manhattan and the winner of our Spelling Bee. We're making it an annual tradition to have the Spelling Bee winner on every year.
But this week...
I have two clarifications I would like to make at the top of the show.
Okay.
Frank just stretched his mouth.
Oh!
Okay, I have two clarifications. One is a friend considerately pointed out that I threw some shade at cardigans last week. And I'm here to say I like cardigans. I have one on right now. And I am pro cardigan. I am sorry that I used that as the representation for the librarian stereotype. What I was trying to really say was that there's a stereotype that librarians are quiet. We've talked about this a million times. It is not necessarily true. Many of us are not quiet. And cardigans Correct. Have nothing to do with it. And I am sorry, cardigans.
Yeah, we just like have to get over that stereotype in every way.
Yes.
Like we should be able to make fun of it and use it. Mm-hmm. But it's just nothing.
Yeah.
Really, at this point.
No.
I mean, but you know, there are some style and there are some characteristics of librarians that persist through the years, but that's, you know, any profession right. in some ways. But
right. Yeah. And it's also just like any job, there's a range of people who are interested in it.
Right.
Yeah.
Especially now.
Yeah.
With all Agreed. The people we've interviewed and
Are you interviewing?
Right? No, all the people we've talked to on this podcast.
Oh, like I was about to younger, say if there's a job open at Jefferson Market, you
oh,
need
no.
to say that.
No, younger okay. kids coming in.
Yeah. Many anyway. Of them wearing cardigans. So sorry. Big cardigan. oh, don't boycott
But they wear
us.
Them ironically. or very consciously about what that cardigan means.
Yeah.
Like embrace the cardigan. Right. I love cardigans, but I don't like cardigans that like bell out at your waist. Like I want a slim fitting.
Mm-hmm.
So almost like Beatles-esque.
Oh, yeah. Those are cute.
High break cardigan.
Mm-hmm. I like those. You know, very like, cute.
Yeah, they are.
See, we're pro
it's hard
cardigan.
To find them. We're very pro cardigan.
Yeah. Okay, that's one thing. Okay, my other thing I want to clarify is I'm going to officially rescind my recommendation for the Netflix series 13 Reasons Why. I stand behind my book recommendation. I think the book is great and important and a really good book to read with your teen, a really good book to read maybe in school, a great book that inspires a lot of conversation. The Netflix series, I will say, I've been watching it as someone who does not have a teenager. I've been watching it and as a piece of art, I am not super in love with it. And I think I have learned my lesson to not recommend things before I have seen the whole thing. Because I thought the first episode was really interesting and promising. And I'm not liking the way the rest of the series is going. And there's been a ton of controversy about it, which we don't need to get into because I just said I'm not going to talk about stuff without having seen the whole thing. But I will say, I think if you have a teen who is watching it, or if you have a teen who's important in your life who is watching it, I think it's a great thing to watch with them and talk about it and not let them just sort of be out there on their own watching it, because I do think it brings up a lot of stuff about suicide that maybe isn't addressed exactly the way you might like to see it addressed.
And that's all you're going to say?
And that's all I'm going to say.
Okay. I won't ask questions.
Okay.
Even though I'm curious. But that's fair to say you won't want to give a concluding statement until it's over.
Yeah.
And they renewed it for another season.
They did.
I heard, so.
They did. And there's been some really interesting stuff. Like if you Google the just like book versus movie or stuff like that, there's some interesting comparisons of the two and the way that the adaptation has worked and some of the things the actors are saying about it sort of promoting conversations about suicide and talking to teens about it more, which like obviously I'm 100% behind that. I'm just not totally sure that the show is the perfect vehicle for it, but again, not necessarily saying that I haven't seen the whole thing and I don't know that I'm gonna finish it. So
I mean, you know, as being a non-parent, I actually just, I love hearing you say, and if actual parents do employ this, like the idea of watching something that isn't particularly perceived as great by the parent, but the kid might want to watch it. And the idea of just talking about it, like there's no, like, again, easy to say as a non-parent, there's no like wrong thing to watch because anything should be discussed, because the kid will go through their life and encounter bad stuff, good stuff, you know, indifferent stuff. They might disagree with you. They might have a point of view you didn't think about. Mm-hmm. And that's sort of really powerful for a kid to actually be able to talk to a parent and mm-hmm. then make a point, maybe.
Yeah.
And also, you know, have the parent make a point.
Right. And I think it's good to sort of experience a piece of culture together, too. Like, it might sort
what's
of
happening
let you...
right now.
Right.
Yeah.
It might let you kind of talk about things in a way that you don't usually, because you have, like, a different kind of dialogue around a film or a movie or a book than you would if you were just like, okay, honey, like, we're in the car. You're a captive audience. Let's talk about suicide. Like, that's a really... That's kind of a tough thing versus having a conversation starter.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, you know, maybe it's a weird way, like, my work is my child. Because, I mean, I don't underestimate this. I really do work collaboratively. And it sounds so, you know, wonderful. Like, I'm a collaborative worker. But I cannot function without other points of view. I mean, because the excitement of also hearing something, like, being so familiar with the library I work in, hearing a point of view that's unexpected is so exciting.
Mm-hmm.
And also to hear something, how I'm perceived, how I might do something that's perceived as not so wonderful, I'm also interested in hearing, because it's like, you know, with good intentions, you sometimes realize, oh, is that how it came across? Mm. And it's another reminder of how communication is so difficult.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Anyway, good comment, Gwen. And
okay.
It's the first time either of us have brought in a sort of qualification.
Mm-hmm.
And that's fair. That's human.
Thanks.
Yeah.
That and the cardigans. Okay. Should we talk about some books?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I guess. You want me to fly in?
Yeah, you fly in.
Well, I did read a book.
Good. Good job, Frank.
And it has many of the elements that I love so much, like New York history of 30, 40 years ago, 70s and 80s history, as well as today. Sex, yes. And it was also written by an author that I've met before in the library in Jefferson Market. So, the producer's probably going to hit me in the head, but I'm going to go ahead anyway, because it's on order, but it hasn't come in yet. The book is itself released, but the library is now processing copies of it. So
that's okay. You can put it on hold if it's showing
you.
Up in the catalog. Yeah.
And I also have copies, too, in my office. So if anyone's around Jefferson Market and asks for Frank and wants to read this book, I'll happily lend it to you.
And wants to see your office, which is really cute.
Oh, huh. It's like
I
a
like
storage closet.
It is like a storage closet, but it's cute.
So,
it feels like you.
Oh.
You have those stamps.
Somewhat. Yeah.
Yeah.
Little library, like rubber stamps. And
do you use
pets.
Those?
For when I play.
When
I take some time
good.
Out, I play
you
with my rubber
play.
Stamps. Anyway, where
anyway,
were we?
Sorry.
Oh, the book I read.
Come get it from your office.
The book I read is called The Ghosts of St. Vincent's by Tom Eubanks, Eubanks. And the St. Vincent's he's referring to is St. Vincent's Hospital, which was the main hospital in Greenwich Village since the 1800s, started by, I believe, like nuns, Catholic nuns. And St. Vincent's, I think is the same, St. Vincent is the patron saint of the indigent. So St. Vincent's Hospital was a standard service in the village for, as I said, since the 1800s. It has since been closed and is now been converted into luxury condominiums. And also,
God
not
bless
only
the
that,
village.
Yeah, four brownstone apartments with their own unique addresses, as they say. And you can imagine this was of some interest to villagers, long-term and not so long-term. So this book, The Ghosts of St. Vincent's, ruminates on that change. Like, how do you get from sisters, nuns, starting a hospital that would serve the underserved and is now a luxury condominium 100-something years later. And the essential story of The Ghosts of St. Vincent's is interesting. Actually, it's interesting. I couldn't quite figure out, is it a memoir or fiction? And I'm curious to see how the catalogers of New York Public Library catalog it, even though there's a complete, you know, revelation in the preface when the author quotes George Santayana and says, "Nothing is wholly historical, nothing is wholly imaginary." And then Tom Eubanks, the author, adds, "I would only add, no one is wholly fictional and no one is wholly real." So there you go.
Mm-hmm.
So the essence of the story is a young Midwestern guy who born in the 60s in the Midwest and deals with his family and his own sexuality and his coming out and his desperate, desperate, as many across the country have, need to get to New York, the holy grail of New York. So he gets to New York in the 80s. And as he says, as a young man growing up in an interesting household who's gay, who comes out to himself first, gets to New York in the 80s, he says, I basically was on a collision course with AIDS, as he puts it. And so he, the essence of that story is his journey to New York, his discovery of his sexuality, his contracting of HIV and then AIDS, and his time spent in St. Vincent's Hospital, which was, as he says, ground zero for the AIDS crisis in the 80s. It was like there was a whole floor devoted to it, almost hearkening back to the nuns that started the hospital, because he talks a lot about the nurses, almost all female at the time, who dealt with them so realistically, dealt with the patients so realistically as the doctors didn't quite, because he takes you through all the different permutations of drugs and testing and hypotheses of what AIDS was all about. And he's very funny. It's a very funny book. What's interesting is that the core of the story is this AIDS journey, and it almost seems like Tom Eubanks, the author of Ghosts of St. Vincent, pulls himself back a little from the experience, clearly his own, I believe, to get the story out there of what literally happened in the hospital, what drugs he was given, how he felt, what other people felt like. He pulls back a bit and gives you not clinical, but a very straightforward story of it. He saves his most elegiac and poignant writing for interwoven, as they say, chapters that deal with other people who intersected with St. Vincent's Hospital from different times. In other words, he talks a lot in the 1800s about an immigrant family from Ireland surviving the Great Famine there, surviving the trip across the ocean to get to New York for a new life. When they land, one by one, die of cholera. And that's how St. Vincent's actually started, to help the cholera epidemic. So he does relate the two epidemics. And there's some funny stories of celebrities that have been to St. Vincent's, of like drug overdoses and stuff. And
when did it close?
A couple of years ago.
Oh, really? That recently?
Oh, yeah. I don't think the condos are even open yet. He actually has a quote in the back of the book that says, before the entitled live here exclusively, the marginalized died in droves.
Wow.
It's sort of potent image when you realize it's an exclusive residence now, and it was a place where people died.
The title, The Ghost of St. Vincent, is very,
it's very well written.
Yeah.
It's very well written. And like I said, the interweaving chapters of different personages, New York personages. He is a master of telling a story succinctly and sort of nailing details that are so human and unique about famous people, like mayors of the city, celebrities, Gloria Vanderbilt, the socialite, makes an appearance. Anderson Cooper's mother, for those of you who know, makes an appearance. Cardinal Spellman, Roy Cohn, the famous lawyer. I mean, it's sort of a real fantasia of stuff.
Wow.
And so I highly recommend it as New York history in the 80s, a rumination again on change, on how New York changes and how things change, and you have to accept it. Like he does say, and I love that he points it out, like it's so easy and so right in some ways to be angry about that change, like, the change of the hospital from one thing to another. But then also that acceptance of nothing quite stays the same. And You gotta go with it and fight it if you can, maybe, if you want to activize, or just accept it, or both.
Try to fight the
condos?
My God. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's still a hot button issue amongst people that come in the library and talk about the neighborhood.
Yeah.
So The Ghosts of St. Vincent's by Tom Eubanks. And
wow.
I think he'll be very happy I talked about the book.
That sounds really good. And
it really is. And it's a book that a lot of people might not have heard of and might be interested in reading. So
you also, when you said Roy Cohn, I can't think about this era and writing without thinking about Angels in America.
Exactly.
The play. Yeah,
exactly.
I know
he makes an appearance in that.
Yeah. Right. He's, oh my gosh. I didn't know much about Roy Cohn before that.
Yeah.
And I was really, I was quite captivated by his story.
And he talks a lot about the, Tom Eubanks in The Ghost of St. Vincent, about a lot of the clubs, and we're almost the same age, a lot of the clubs and East Village places he went to in the 80s. And I was like, oh, I remember that place and the drag queens that frequented them. And, you know, really cool.
Have you known the author since then? Like, did you know him at that time?
No, I only knew him from the library.
Okay.
As he says now, because the village has changed so much in terms of expense, he now lives in upstate Manhattan because he can't really afford the village anymore and lives way uptown. So I don't see him as much. He uses libraries up there.
Yeah.
But he sent me a copy of the book. And, you know, I'm up front. But and he even said very sweetly in the note, he says, you know, here's my book and I hope you like it. And if you do, please tell other people, which I'm doing right now. Uh-huh. And if you don't, he said, as Deborah Carr said in Tea and Sympathy, please be kind. So he was well aware, like, I don't have to like it. I'm not pushing something I don't like. I did like it. I did enjoy it. And I'm glad I read it. Mm-hmm. I hope other people do too.
Awesome. That sounds like a great read.
Yeah. So I do have,
keep going?
Actually, what?
You want to keep going?
I do have one other book that, so actually I was, I came across a book in the library where actually a teenage boy was checking out, and I saw the title, which intrigued me, called Poems, because I'm always interested in reading poems lately, poetry, and just digging back into that. Poems That Make Grown Men Cry, which I was a little bit like, about. Here we go with another stereotype of men don't cry.
Men don't cry, yeah.
I'm like, all right, I get it. I get what you're going. So it's basically, you know, 100 famous people, famous men, literature, acting, all fields, who submit to this book a poem that actually affected them very deeply or made them cry. Mm-hmm. And it's really interesting just to go through it. And I was also like, you know, oh, well, they're not talking to me, not the man like I am, because I'm like sensitive and cry. But then I was also like, I'm not going to cry. Like, I'm not going to read one of these poems and cry.
You're like, I'm going to fight the stereotype both ways.
Yeah. I'm like, you know, you're not getting anything from me.
Right.
And then I was looking through it and I was just going to, you know, wanted to read one here.
Yeah. And
I,
and then you were weeping copiously. Well,
a little bit.
Yeah.
I read, I saw Stanley Tucci put one. Stanley Tucci's an actor who I think is so good.
I know who
he's
Stanley
so
Tucci
good.
Is.
He just played, actually, Jack Warner, the big Hollywood mogul in the Feud miniseries with Jessica Lange and Susan Sarandon. He was so good. He was in Devil Wears Prada. So many great movies. Mm-hmm. Just a all-around hilariously good actor. So I was like, all right. And then I saw his poem was by a poet named Theodore Rothke, who is a mid-century, last-century poet who I've actually always really, really liked. So I was like, all right, I'll read it. And it was called, the poem's called My Papa's Waltz.
Is this going to make
me
cry?
And I was already
cry?
Like, Papa. Whenever they use the name Papa, I already get like,
do I need to
like,
be prepared for this, right?
Papa, can you hear me? Can you understand me? You know what that is. Barbara Streisand, Yentl.
I'm sorry. Right,
moving on. It's called My Papa's Waltz by Stanley Tucci. My Papa's Stanley Waltz Tucci. By Theodore Rothke, recommended by Stanley Tucci, who apparently was very affected by it. Okay. My Papa's Waltz. The whiskey on your breath could make a small boy dizzy, but I hung on like death. Such waltzing was not easy. We romped until the pans slid from the kitchen shelf. My mother's countenance could not unfrown itself. The hand that held my wrist was battered on one knuckle. At every step you missed, my right ear scraped a buckle. You beat time on my head with a palm caked hard by dirt, then waltzed me off to bed, still clinging to your shirt. See, I'm crying. Fucking... Oh, I'm crying. I mean, like, dads. Okay, dads, you know, whatever. Dads. Sons and dads.
That's a beautiful poem.
You know, it's in a way cheesy.
It's totally cheesy, but it's totally wonderful.
I can't
wonderful.
Believe I'm actually tearing up now.
Because
like,
it's beautiful.
Just, like, it's something about that sort of dad thing, and then there's that clinging image of, like, boys and their fathers, like, you know, love, hate in a way, competition. Mm. Oh, and I actually thought I'd just be like, yeah, when I read it, but it does get you.
Yeah.
It just, like, gets you. It seems sort of like trite, but it's not. So
poetry
anyway.
Poetry is amazing like
I
that.
I can't believe I was crying. Oh. Anyway, it's beautiful, yeah, and I love Stanley Tucci for... I didn't know that poem of Theodore Rothke's, and I really want to read more about his poetry. So I recommend...
Yeah, you can vouch for this book. The title is true.
Yeah, Poems That Make Grown Men Cry. Even though I'd say I'm not grown yet.
Yeah.
That could be my... See, I'm just resisting this whole...
The whole thing, right?
The
whole
concept. But, and they also talk about the people, the celebrities who put forward these poems also talk a little bit about why this poem mm-hmm. affected them. So it's a good book. It's called Poems That Make Grown Men Cry, 100 Men on the Words That Move Them, edited by Anthony and Ben Holden.
Is there a story before each one about why the people who contributed the poems chose them?
Yeah. And there's a foreword by the two. It's a father and son, Anthony and Ben Holden, who mm-hmm. actually put this book together. Mm-hmm. So read more poetry, mm-hmm. like I did, and cry embarrassingly on air.
That reminds me of, did you ever read The Tin Drum? You remember that book?
Günter Grass?
Yeah.
No.
There's a, at the very beginning, it's a book about World War II and Nazis and occupation and very difficult times. And there's an image that's always stayed with me about where in the very beginning, people go to, you know, it's fiction, it's a story, but people go to this like underground club, and they cut onions. And it makes everyone cry because they need that sort of like emotional release, and they need an excuse for some kind of catharsis to happen. And so they, you know, the onions are releasing
fumes.
It's
so interesting to me.
Yeah. Right. I think about that all the time. For some reason, that image, that book is actually incredible and has a lot of images that stay with me.
What's interesting about that is just like the recognition in some level of the human need to do certain things. Mm-hmm. And to do then if you're not getting it in some way, to do it in a seemingly artificial way. Mm-hmm. Actually, I'll just throw out my non-book recommendation right now because I just thought of it when you said that, is a movie called Miss Sloane, starring Jessica Chastain. Mm. And she plays like a sort of super, super aggressive, career-conscious Washington, D.C. lobbyist. And, you know, like win at all costs, you know, corporations hire her to promote their causes. And it talks a lot about Washington doings and how it works, but in a really, really fascinating way, a really, really interesting way. But she's so highly ambitious and controlled and determined to do what she does for whatever reasons. I like that they don't go too much in a backstory. They don't show like her as a little girl, like with her parents being abused or whatever, to explain why she is the way she is. Mm-hmm. But yet the performance by Jessica Chastain really pushes that forward. And there's scenes, which I thought was really nice that they put these in. She basically hires a guy to take care of certain needs of hers. And she's very businesslike about it. But mm-hmm. what I liked about it was that she's acknowledging, all right, I have these needs, but I'm going to fit them into my schedule. They're not going to be like in a romance or anything like that. So we're just going to have this happen. And actually, there's a poignant sub-story with that guy that she hires later when she's on trial, a serious trial for something that happens, which could bring her completely down. So the movie Miss Sloane with Jessica Chastain was really cool. You just reminded me of that.
Wow.
So there's my panoply of lovely choices.
Wow. Those are some really good choices.
Thanks. So what's up with you?
So I read a grown-up book for
Yay.
Once. to everyone's relief. It's called Foxlow, Foxlowe, by Eleanor Wasserberg, who's a British author, and it was published in the UK last summer. It's her debut novel, which it always impresses me when authors write incredible debut novels, because I'm just like, A, how did you do that? B, how did you get it? How did you find an agent? C, how did they sell it to a publisher? Like, D, how did it get marketed well enough to actually get into anyone's hands? Like, the process of starting out in the fiction writing business is really tough.
Yeah.
This book totally, I think, deserves it. It's really creepy. You can see from the cover, it is this sort of very atmospheric, like, setting-based thing. And it's about a cult. And this little girl who's growing up in the cult, her name is Green. Major trigger warning on this book. Bad things happen to children. In this book, they get physically and emotionally abused, and it's really vivid in a way that I was not quite expecting when I started. And if I had been, I probably would not have picked it up. But it is not taken lightly. Like, the book, I think, does a really amazing job of talking about the sort of like psychological factors that go into like groupthink and into people buying into this completely separate ideology that the leader of this cult has developed. it's like the people are divided into the grown and ungrown because there's a couple of kids. Like it starts out with a new baby coming who Green names Blue. And so Green, it's sort of the story of Green and Blue and this other boy who are there. And it has a super intense tone. So I wanted to read a little bit of it out loud.
Oh, yeah.
We've decided that it's fun to read things out loud, so we're trying to do it more.
I like it.
Yeah.
You get a taste of what the writer's about.
Right, too. Exactly. So the setup for this is sort of that the like founding premise of the cult is that there's the bad, and the bad can get inside your body, and the bad can get inside the house. The house's name is Foxlow, same as the title of the book. And it's this like incredible old mansion with a ballroom that used to, you know, is sort of crumbling into decay now. Okay. So this is Green. This is sort of Green quoting the founding members' rules that she sets up for life on this commune. Listen to the things we know to protect yourself. The bad thrives on the dark and the cold. It is a winter force. So be careful when the sun is weak and the air bites you. Stay off the moor where the bad is strong. If the bad catches you there, run to the standing stones. Even in the winter, the stones hum with 1,000 ancient blessings. If you are closer to Foxlow, run so you are inside the scattering salt. If, despite all our care, you feel the bad has taken you, you must tell the founders. They will take you to the stones if the sun is strong enough and solstice is close. In winter, you will be given candle flame on the skin to try to force the bad out. It hates heat. If the infection is deep, you may be bled. Summer solstice will heal you if nothing else works, and you may have to wait for the double sunset. The children are easiest for the bad to slip into. They must be watched.
Wow.
Super creepy. It's really scary.
Good for you for plunging in, because you're not the bravest when it comes to super creepy.
Thank you for praising me for that. I felt I deserved praise for that. It's really scary. And it also has this, like, the narrator is a totally unreliable narrator. You're like, you're never quite sure exactly what's going on because it's being filtered through her thoughts. And it also is, the end is really, really ambiguous. And it's like, I don't want to spoil anything, but I felt like it was sort of wrapping up toward an okay ending, if not a happy one. And then the very last couple sentences, you're like, what are you doing?
Really?
And it's really, but then you think back and you're like, right, why would a book like this have a happy ending? But it just, it's really, really creepy.
Well, one of the reviews in the back got me because they cite two of my favorite authors, a terrifying coming-of-age novel with echoes of both Shirley Jackson and Emily Bronte. Foxlow creeped me out of my skin.
Yes.
Woo-hoo.
Super creepy. And nice. Yeah, it does feel like Shirley Jackson. Mm. It feels like we have always lived in the castle. Like, it's very...
What a great recommendation.
Yeah, so that's my recommendation. Foxlow by Eleanor Wasserberg.
Oh, you know what I should say? Have you seen... It's not a lot, but like the Twitter fire about my lack of reading Harry Potter.
Yes.
But there's a Twitter Mrs. Weasley.
From Robin. It's Robin and Biana.
That was there?
Didn't you realize that? Yeah. Right. Jeez,
I'm so stupid.
Actually Robin. Actually, her name is Robin Ravenclaw.
Right, it is Robin there. Yeah. Oh, she's so cute. I didn't connect.
These are our guests from a couple weeks ago who do Black Girls Create.
My, you know, lack of Harry Potter. But
I love it. It's so awesome. She's totally
sent me a GIF or GIF or GIF, whatever the kids call it. And it was when I said, yeah, like you said, are you reading Harry Potter? Like on Twitter. And I said, Jefferson Market, like, yeah, sure. Yeah, I guess I am. And then they sent a GIF that said, which was like a Hermione, like, I don't believe
right.
you.
Right. They're like and giving then, you the eye. Like...
And then I said, okay, I'm going to give as good as I'm getting. And I tweeted back a GIF of Harry Potter and Hermione and Ron turning around saying, judging you, and meaning like, don't judge me. And then they favored it or liked it. And I thought that was so cute. But I also should say that in this book, Poems That Make Grown Men Cry, there was another poem that actually punched me in the face. I'll be masculine and say, punch me in the face, rather than made me cry.
Yeah.
Selected by Daniel Radcliffe, who I do adore as an actor and seemingly it seems like a wonderful person. The poem he chose is in like very Cockney dialect. British dialect, so I would have read it if I could pull that off. I should have rehearsed, but it was another beautiful poem. So yes, I'm keeping my fingers in and toes in the Harry Potter world by putting forward something by Daniel Radcliffe in this poetry
book. The same as reading the books.
I'm gonna have to read the second Harry
you
Potter
are.
For our challenge. I can't not.
Well, is it going to be fresh? I think you should do it because you want to, Frank, and not just because I made you. Oh.
I need to be challenged. Soaring Robin and Bayam. Dear, they're going to hate me. All right.
Actually, Daniel Radcliffe leads into my non-book recommendation really well, because at the producer's recommendation, this should actually be his recommendation, I listened to the Nancy podcast on WNYC to the episode called There Are No Gay Wizards, which I think is only their fifth episode. It was so good and so funny. And there's an interview in there where they're playing tape of this interview of J.K. Rowling, who is talking to Daniel Radcliffe. And so he's sort of like in there and they're talking about Dumbledore and whether Dumbledore is gay. And like it, they do a really, really good job of unpacking the whole thing. They do. It's like a very thorough examination of one teeny tiny part of that conversation that we had with Robin and Bayana. And it's a great listen. It's really funny. They interview such awesome people, like all, because I've listened to the whole thing now. So I've listened to all, I think there's only like six episodes, but that is a great podcast. So it's the Nancy podcast on WNYC.
Ooh, all right.
Also, somebody is, they also interview Jackson Bird on that, who is from the Harry Potter Alliance, who I've wanted to have on this podcast forever. I've had his business card like stuck into the little like frame above my desk for like a year, and somehow I just never got around to it. But we're Jackson Bird, if you're listening, we're gonna try to get you on here because I think you're really cool.
Ooh,
yeah.
Harry Potter, what a phenomenon yeah. that little
but
book
was,
is.
It was cool though. Become. Another thing that like kind of that little book,
a little book by right? that lady in Britain. She's got a good career going yeah. for herself.
Yeah, and speaking of how hard it is to get a first time book published, I love all those like apocryphal stories about how she sent it to 60 billion people before anybody.
Or
picked
she wrote
it
in her car.
She wrote it. Well, I think she wrote it in a cafe. Oh. I don't think she was homeless, but she was
didn't
on the
have a lot of resources.
She didn't have a lot of resources, sure. And she had an infant, and yeah. she yeah. And also, it was rejected by multiple publishers, who I'm sure have kicked themselves every day since. Because
one thing I should say, and then I'll stop.
Business.
Oh, is that for the lack of reading Harry Potter, I do adore the adoration of Harry Potter.
Mm-hmm.
I love that it's this phenomenon. I love that people love it. I love the love of it. I mean, it's a worthy thing to love, and it's a worthy thing to discuss.
And it's so cool that people,
I think it's
like,
wonderful. Yeah, it's like, a wonderful thing. People, I wish I could catch fire with it.
Yeah.
Maybe I will.
You
I
haven't
have
gotten
to
the really good stuff yet.
I know. That's why I will. You know what?
But
I can't make promises, but I'll try. Okay, I'm
sure. It makes me really happy that people like Jackson Bird and the Harry Potter Alliance also use that energy and enthusiasm behind fandom to like turn it for the good, right? Like they do really amazing practical social justice stuff. They raise all kinds of money. They have this project called the Lumos Project.
Amazing.
That like, right, it's real. And it's like making a real difference in the world. It's incredible.
I mean, talking to those two, Mrs. Weasley and, and Robin and our Black Girls Create, was like wonderful.
Yeah.
It was just a great really perspective good. They had, and they were so smart. And,
yeah.
Yeah. Shout out to them again.
I also watched one of, I'm forgetting what it's called now. The web series that they recommended, The Quarter Life Crisis, reminded me of The Quarter Life Crisis. I watched it. It's super
YouTube.
Cute. Yeah, it's on YouTube. It's really, really cute. You should totally check that out if you haven't yet.
All I'll say is Quarter Life Crisis ain't nothing compared to The Half-Life Crisis.
I'm going to get to The Half-Life Crisis soon.
Well,
it's going to be fun.
I'll be waiting for you.
Yeah. Aw, thanks,
with
Frank.
With a little cake and tea, just to make it easier, because it's going to be hell. No, I'm kidding.
Can I have coffee instead? I don't like
tea. Yeah, of course.
Thanks, Frank. It makes me feel better to know you'll be there. All right. I think that we are done for today. So please check out the show page. Go to nypl.org/podcast to see a full rundown of our episodes. You can leave a comment on the blog. You can leave a comment in iTunes.
And actually, your department's Twitter is at @nyplrecommends.
Correct.
Which is where I got a lot of this Harry Potter heat.
Yes, come to NYPL Recommends and torment Frank about Harry Potter.
My
please.
Library is at JMarket Library.
Yeah, on Twitter.
On Twitter.
Okay.
Yeah, so.
All right, great. Thanks so much for listening, everybody, and we will see you next week.
Bye.